Look, for me, I think it's important that we have to understand the need for employment equity. My view is that we are a country that is coming out of the legacy of apartheid discrimination, and the apartheid has created so many divisions and structural inequalities, which we have to address to make equality real for all our people. The workplace, of course, is no different. There are a number of disparities that reflect themselves in terms of employment, occupation, and income. And of course, there are those that are pronounced, as having, the most exposure to discrimination. Here, I'm thinking about Black women in particular. But there is a need, because that's the kind of argument that I'm going to be pushing and, in my presentation. I'm going to back it up with some facts. For example, I had an opportunity to go through the 23rd Commission for Employment Equity annual report for 2022 to 2023, and I think it was released last month. And the report informs us about the kind of the current, a representation, of the demographics in South Africa. And in particularly, they're focusing on top management as well as senior management. And the report tells us about that about 62.9% of top management is still white, while the AP is at 8%. And they also tell us that 22% of that is white female. They also tell us that the African population group, whose EAP is 80%, accounts for only 16.9%, which 6% is African female. They also tell us that the colored population, whose EAP is 9.3%, accounts for 6.1% at this top management level. The Indian population group, representing at 11.2%, with an EAP of 2.7 at this level. The representation of foreign nationals stands at 3.0 at this level. And it's only about 1.7 of top management is made up of people with disabilities. So what this report tells us is that African representation at this level is less than a quarter of their EAP. They also tell us that whites at nearly five times their EAP still dominate at this level. Male representation is more than double the representation of women at this stage. And it's also quite interesting because they also took some time to focus on higher education in our sector. And the trends there that out of the 26 universities that reported, there was one that did not submit a report. And of course, that they have not been providing accurate analysis of the trends that are happening within the environment. And also interesting for me that the report suggests that although there's been an increase in number of African population by 3.7 from 2020 to 2022, their representation still remains well below their EAP at the top management level. Of course, UWC is doing quite well, I must say, and but I think general, it's a kind of a general analysis. And they also say to us that the increase of female by 4% from 2020 to 2022, and their representation still remains below their EAP at this level. So there are a number of issues that are raising, which indicate, of course, that there isn't much that has been done to progress on employment equity. But how do you address this? We cannot just be lamenting, that the numbers are not looking good, but we have to do something. Are we supposed to change the laws or to allow, the markets to correct the inefficiencies? And I think the response we get, which is direct from the answer case, City of Cape Town, whereby the judge told us that there is a duty on all employers to implement affirmative action. And as well, I think the most celebrated decision early times of employment equity and affirmative action was the National Coalition for Gay and Lesbian Equality versus the Minister of Justice, where the Constitutional Court stated the following: having regard to South Africans' exceptional inegalitarian past, discrimination would not end with the repeal of discriminatory laws. Such discrimination would usually be ongoing unless it is specifically remedied, like justice. Equality delayed is equality denied. And of course, you remember the American experience, particularly the quote from President Lyndon Johnson, where he said, "You do not take a person who for years has been hobbled by chains and liberate him by bringing up to the starting line in a race and say you are free to compete with others and still just try to believe that you have been completely fair." Close quote. So obviously, it takes us to why exactly do we have the Employment Equity Act? You can get it, obviously, from the purpose of the act, which mainly is to achieve equity in the workplace by promoting equal opportunity and fair treatment in employment through the elimination of unfair discrimination. It's also talking about the implementation of affirmative actions to redress the disadvantages that have been experienced, particularly by the previously and historical disadvantaged. So if you come back now to the topic of the day in terms of the amendments to the Employment Equity Act, what is interesting are the issues around sectoral targets, which have generated a lot of discussion. So the new section, which is section 15A, capital A, introduces sectoral numerical targets. And of course, the purpose of this addition is to ensure the equitable representation of people from designated groups. Again, the amendment is also meant to empower the Minister of Employment and Labor to identify national economic sector for the purpose of administration and determining numerical targets for each sector. And I think that's another thing that is creating a lot of contention. But how are these sectoral targets determined? Look, sorry, I'm rushing ahead of myself here. How are these sectoral targets? Now, look, the amendments empower, as I mentioned, on the minister to identify and set employment equity numerical targets for each national economic sector. The numerical targets will be determined by the minister, of course, in consultation with the Commission for Employment Equity. And all the proposals in relation to identifying the sector and setting numerical targets for sectors have been published for comment, and sectors have been given an opportunity. I'm happy to announce that we as higher education have been quite involved with the Department of Employment and Labor. And I think we are in a position to say that we are, do agree with some of the proposals that are making. Obviously, having the sectoral targets will not in itself, you know, assist, but there has to be a way of ensuring that there's action. But I like what the Department of Labor has done, Employment and Labor, and in terms of engaging and ensuring that everyone has an opportunity, you know, to participate. As a fact, they've published the for comments the sectoral targets, and I think the date was closed on the 11th of June, and whereby I think we had an opportunity for all of us at the different sectors, you know, to engage, you know, and to our views. But the numeric targets focus on top and senior management, as well as professional qualified and skilled level. And with people with disabilities, it does not focus on semi-skilled and unskilled. Again, the targets are tabulated according to race and gender, as well as disability. And they look in terms of the national and provincial percentage. And also the targets outline in each of these racial and gender categories. What is ideal? What, again, you know, the sectors have to align themselves. And of course, we still expect that the department might provide us further guidelines. But can we apply them on a provincial, because the kind of debate that has been taking place, national versus provincial or regional, you know? And the view actually, I think sensible from the department is that it leaves it to the various sectors, and it has not used must, use may, that a designated employer may not apply both national but you give them that kind of discretion that they can decide, you know. And again, at which job levels I've mentioned, you know, that this is again focused mainly on top senior management, professional qualified and skilled and technical. So they have not published those that for semi-skilled and unskilled, which I think at some stage it's necessary, because this is the kind of a group that needs to, you know, to move up, you know, it's a pipeline, you know. However, designated employers obviously are required to take into account the economical active population in respect of each level, you know, and also in terms of the EAP category that is provided. So we'll always use the EAP as a benchmark, you know. And the question then that has been coming up quite strongly, we have our employment equity plans, and we also have the view that there is these sectoral targets, but when are they going to be implemented? Currently, they've been published, as I mentioned, and I think the closing date was the 11th, as I mentioned. But when the final, you know, is being published, I think it will inform us exactly what is it that we need to take. But how do we, in terms of ensure that they are linked to the employment equity plans? An amendment to Section 20 of the Act, and which deals with the employment equity plans, links the numerical targets to the numerical targets set by designated employers in its employment equity plan. In other words, it says if you have your employment equity plan, you need to align that employment equity plan with these numerical sectoral targets. You know, I think that's the kind of a great way, because you are not starting there, you know, from nothing. You know, there you have something. So an amendment to Section 42 aligns the assessment, because obviously once you've aligned, you need to assess and ensure that you are compliant with the employment equity requirements as stated. But obviously, besides this generating a lot of anxiety, you know, I think the Department of Employment and Labor this time has been great in also extending concessions. I know that the BMF is against this concession, but these concessions are important so that they can be able to manage them. So the EA applies to employees and employers who are operated, designated, you know, kind of operations, you know, from 50 upwards. And except, of course, I think there's always been the exclusion of the National Defense Force, the NI, and the South African Service, the Secret Service. But it applies to employers, excluding those that are listed above, as well as those that are mentioned that are employing less than 50. So it brings about a change, you know, to the designated employer, which we used to have in the past. And I think it should be a welcome, you know, kind of a, you know, concession from the Department of Employment and Labor. So I think perhaps if people can understand that, because obviously there's always the view that if you stifle the small businesses, you also stifle the growth of the economy. But I think they've taken that into consideration. But there's also another element that has been raised, you know, if you're setting, you're imposing sectoral targets, is it not about imposing quotas? So is the issue of quotas versus targets? You know, obviously the law distinguishes between quota and numerical target or goals. A quota, as we know, obviously is quite rigid, and it amounts to job preservation. But a target, as we understand, it is quite flexible, realistic and achievable. And quotas are prohibited, of course, in terms of the employment equity, as you understand, because if you introduce quotas, you're imposing barriers, particularly in terms of employment of designated group, which is not the intention, you know, of the employment equity, because it talks about equal opportunities. And Section 15 of the Act states that a designated employer is not required to take any decision concerning an employment policy or practice that will establish an absolute barrier to the prospect or continued employment or advancement of people who are not from the designated groups. So now, of course, I think there's also an obligation, you know, in designing the Employment Equity Act, and in this case is in relation to consulting with unions. And in this, I think it's been great that the Department of Labor also has created that kind of an opportunity that, although we are setting, you know, numerical sectoral targets, but there's still an opportunity for you to consult. But they are asking us to consult, particularly with unions. And they've clarified that in terms of Section 16, you know. So where there's a representative, which is quite interesting that I picked up, a representative trade union, and the designated employer is required to consult with that union and not with employees. But I think it's always been the case, but I think they're emphasizing it now, is to give credence and, you know, and acknowledgement to the role that unions, and unions obviously in the past have never seen this as involvement, because they always saw it as benefiting the middle and upper management, you know. But I think by involving them, I think that is quite critical. But what has also been interesting for me are the reasonable accommodation issues that I think we've been talking about. There's always been a confusion around the definition of disability. And I think these amendments are providing that kind of certainty, you know, in relation. And again, there's also this one of the certification of psychological, you know, practitioners in order to conduct the test. And I think they're also given a kind of concession that there's no necessity, you know, in this case. So I think they are making a lot of concession, you know, to their credit, you know, in order to be able to meet, you know, the kind of interest. But of course, they've got a carrot in the stick in their approach. And hence, they've now looked in terms of the amendments in relation to Section 53 of the year dealing with state contracts. And that provides that the minister may only issue a compliance certificate, which is something new. And I think we've been talking about it since, the Employment Equity Act, you know, was passed in 1999. And I'm glad that the Department of Labor has realized that it is critical as a way of trying to enforce and ensure that there's compliance around this. And I think it's a welcome. I think the BMF and all the other groups and so on, the pressure groups that have been seeing this as a toothless legislation, they'll see a kind of benefit, you know, and also the submission of reports in terms of Section 21, you know, and the Department of Labor. I would have wished that the Department of Labor appoints auditors in terms of inspectors, you know, to deal with this. But I think we have to accept, you know, that they want also the inspectors to be empowered to do some kind of. I'm just rounding up now, but obviously, I think the welcoming the department in terms of the enforcement mechanisms, which have not been coming quite strongly in the previous, you know, version of the Act, and the amendments of Section 37 to empower the minister to make regulations regarding the manner of compliance orders in relation to affirmative action compulsory for employers. I think that is also a welcome kind of initiative. And Section 242, as I mentioned, you know, which include the assessment, the thorough assessment, you know, before they, I think the issue of the DG, their reviews and so on, I think they are reinforcing them, you know, to be at least more effective and giving more powers in terms of Section 36 to the labor inspectors. But I also like the last one in relation to the fines, you know, of course, there were fines in the past and so on that, but I think now the way that they push them are quite more realistic and you can be able to understand them. Thank you so much. I think let me stop there, you know, and I think for me, it's a balanced legislation and there is a carrot and a stick kind of approach for the Department of Employment and Labor. And I think obviously they've tried, you know, to satisfy everyone in terms of this legislation. It has to be welcome. Thank you so much.
Shamima, can we hand the floor to you then? I think you're still muted. Okay.
Yes, thank you. Hi, Meko. I've heard your presentation and nice to meet you online. I must say I have a different view to the current regulations and the amendments to the Employment Equity Act. And I think that it's important to go back to the jurisprudence before we come back to the current amendments. So employment equity is really based on the kind of principle that's contained in the Constitution. And in broad terms, the principle is that institutions should, or the composition of institutions or employers should really be broadly representative of the South African demographics. The term broadly representative, I think, is important. what that imported, I think, into the principle of affirmative action, and I think that generally the principle of affirmative action is a noble one. The question is, how have we dealt with it in our legislation, and how has it been interpreted by our courts, particularly the Constitutional Court? So what the Employment Equity Act provides is that remedial measures, including such as affirmative action, can be instituted in relation to what the Act describes, and I think importantly in Section 15 of the Employment Equity Act. And if I could just read Section 15 out for your benefit, it says, affirmative measures are measures designed to ensure that suitably qualified people from designated groups have equal employment opportunities and are equitably represented in all occupational categories and levels in the workforce of a designated employer. So that has got to be read with the empowering provision in the Constitution, and that is that the workplace must be broadly representative. What does that mean, and what are we talking about when we say employment opportunities? Section 15 of the Employment Act is quite clear that it's forward-looking. It's about opportunities that come up in the workplace going forward. And the reason for that is to ensure a slow but important transition into a workplace that must be constituted very differently to the old days. That principle was also obtained or premised on the jurisprudence that emanated from the Canadian courts, particularly that of the Canadian Supreme Court. And if I could just quote a very short quotation from a judgment of the Canadian Supreme Court in Travail des Femmes, which was late 1980s judgment, in which the court said that an employment equity program is an attempt to ensure that future applicants and workers from the affected group will not face the same insidious barriers that blocked their forebears. Again, it's forward looking. It's not in relation to terminating current employment. It's about employment opportunities as and when they arrive going forward from the time of the promulgation of the employment. Effectively became almost a hard-lined one towards affirmative action measures. Just to broadly summarize for the benefit of people who've forgotten what the Barnard judgment or the facts of the Barnard judgment, they were broadly this. She was a captain in the South African police force. She was white and she was female. There was a position that was advertised, one higher than the post that she was in. She falls into a designated group and she applied for the post. She was interviewed by a diverse panel, very important fact in the scheme of facts relating to Barnard. She was recommended as the best person for that position in circumstances when the statistics about criminal activity in the country was probably at its highest. That recommendation was not acted upon, and the position was withdrawn. Barnard applied again. In the second round, once again, she was interviewed by a diverse panel who recommended her appointment. Now, this is the second time. Her percentages are way beyond 85 or just above 85 and 86. And she's the best candidate. She's female. She falls into the designated group. Well, why didn't they appoint her? Because in that category of appointments, white females was exceeded the demographics in terms as reflected in the employment equity plan. She would have been the fifth person in that category that would have exceeded the numbers for that category of position. In other words, the employer, SAPS, would have exceeded the target set in the employment equity plan. What Moseneke, Justice Moseneke indicated in that judgment was that employment equity measures have to be measures that are reasonable. That reasonableness is reflected in the employment equity plan. And so you're entitled as the employer to look at your employment equity plan and then say, well, can we appoint this candidate? Well, you can't if you've exceeded the target set in your employment equity plan. Now, if there was ever a set of facts that indicated that there was one person who deserved to be appointed in circumstances in which our country badly or sorely needed expertise of the kind that she offered, well, then she wasn't. And that was because the employer in that case exceeded its targets. And what happened in that in Bana judgment was that the target set in the employment equity plan of the SAPS effectively became a quota. Now, what does the Constitutional Court say in that judgment? It says that once an employer says that they have refused or it has refused to employ somebody because the employer has exceeded its targets, that is a decision that falls within Section 6.2 of the Employment Equity Act. In other words, it's an affirmative action measure. You can never challenge an affirmative action measure according to the Employment Equity Act on the basis of fairness. In other words, you can only attack an employment equity plan on a rule of law basis. That is what the Constitutional Court has done. Effectively, the substance of that majority judgment, even though it produced four judgments, the majority judgment was that in order to ensure uniform application of the employment equity measures, an employer must apply its targets set out in its employment equity plan. Now, that judgment, I think, is important because the judgment that followed in the solidarity judgment reinforced that principle. Now, what does an employer do in those circumstances? Well, let me just step back a little bit. Is that the effect of the Constitutional Court judgment is that such measures must be implemented, number one. Number two, they must follow the targets that are set in the employment equity plan. And any failure to appoint will be justifiable as an affirmative action measure. The problem, I think, with that approach is the effect is that it's a numbers game. And that brings me to the second point, broad point that I want to talk about. That is, you will recall that the justification or the rationality behind affirmative action measures is to ensure that disadvantaged groups who had suffered in the past will have access to employment opportunities going forward that they never had before. What the Employment Equity Act doesn't do is that it doesn't tell you how and when there should be a differentiation between the different categories that form the designated groups. To be direct, it doesn't tell you when there should be a differentiation between, for instance, an Indian female and a Black female, African female, or an Indian female, for instance, and a colored female, let's say. What the effect of the Barnard judgment is that the demographics must dictate who you employ and when you employ. Now, let's play a bit of a numbers game as a result of that. In a large employer such as the SAPS, for instance, there are many, many jobs. If you apply the demographics, and roughly speaking, let's say 90% African, 87% African, 11% white, 11% perhaps colored, or 10%, and a few percent Indian. What that does is that you're representing the demographics in your workplace, but you're not necessarily improving the position of the minority groups who have been disadvantaged in the past. In fact, if you're using the demographics as a standard, well, then you're probably going to have a lot more white candidates in your workplace than you are either colored or African. And that is a source of great problem for me from a fundamental principle point of view, because it doesn't satisfy the disadvantage suffered by those minority groups in the past. That's the first thing. The second thing is, in relation to the top jobs in larger employers and in public institutions, those will, if you're applying those percentages, primarily be occupied by African and by white candidates. And if you're lucky, perhaps one or two colored candidates, not any Indian candidates. Those are the raw facts with which we have to deal with in relation to employment equity. What the regulations do is really to reinforce what the judgments of the Constitutional Court have held, that in applying affirmative action measures, you must comply with your employment equity plan. The regulations simply tell you in more detail what those targets are by applying the demographics both locally or regionally and at a national level. Now, if the jurisprudence hasn't had the effect of making sure that the Employment Equity Act and the affirmative action measures in that act, anticipated in that act, are not complied with, then by comparison and equal logic, the regulations are not going to have that effect. It really is a reinforcement of what the Constitutional Court has held in Barnard and in the Solidarity Judgment. That's really the impact for me in relation to or the interpretation from my perspective of those regulations. But I'd like to just go a step forward and just deal with, I think it's important to deal with this settlement agreement that has been concluded by Solidarity with the government, or mainly the Department of Labor. I know that there have been many articles, brief articles published by many law firms indicating that the agreement signed by the parties, that is between Solidarity and the department, doesn't really affect the current law as it now stands. I think there are two provisions in that agreement, and I'm not sure how the parties anticipated that this agreement would be made an order of court. In terms of which provision it would be made an order of court is a different issue completely, and one that I don't want to kind of get into now, but I think there are complex issues that arise in relation to that issue. There are two parts of this agreement that I'd like to draw your attention to. The one is paragraph B of that agreement, and it says, affirmative action shall be applied in a nuanced way as embodied in this agreement, and the economically active population statistics will only be one of many factors that will be taken into account in the compliance analysis of affirmative action in any workplace. that part of that paragraph B, that the economically active population statistics will only be one of many factors that will be taken into account in the compliance analysis of affirmative action in any workplace, almost goes against what the Constitutional Court in Barnard held. So it's a very vaguely drafted paragraph, but it does suggest a more broader approach to affirmative action than the Constitutional Court anticipated. There's also the paragraph F that I think has some implications, and that is that the parties agree that there will be no penalties or disadvantages if affirmative action or employment equity plans are not complied with. That's really acting in relation or responding in relation to the current regulations. So at some level, a proper assessment of this agreement will tell you that it was too short an agreement, too weakly drafted an agreement, one that's pretty vague in substance, but that any agreement of this kind should have been more comprehensive, taking into account the implications of the judgments that have arisen from the Constitutional Court. Precisely what kind of meaning will be given to a two-pager agreement between two of the big players in the labor market field, I don't know. But I do think that those two paragraphs have an implication in relation to the current amendments to the Employment Equity Act, and they were intended perhaps implicitly to deal with the consequences of the the other contribution is this, that if you have a look at the Supreme Court of Appeals judgment in the Barnard matter about simply applying demographics or the targets in your employment equity plan in a mechanical fashion, this is what the Supreme Court of Appeal had to say in that judgment before it was overturned by the Constitutional Court. The judgment says, simply put, the Employment Equity Act was designed to assist in the national struggle to achieve an egalitarian society by putting in place measures to overcome historical obstacles and disadvantages and provide equal opportunities for all. The most virulent opponents of such measures will be hard put to argue against its noble purpose. Likewise, the most ardent supporters of such measures, I venture, would find it difficult to argue with any conviction that the end result envisaged at the beginning of this paragraph can be obtained by the mechanical application of formula and numerical targets. Such an exercise would in any event fall foul of Section 15, subsection 3 of the Employment Equity Act, which prohibits quotas. The balance to be achieved in our path to a noble end is what this case is about. And in line with that kind of sentiment, you know, I'd simply just like to add that if there's a strict application of national demographics or strict application of the target set out in your employment equity plan, it does convert targets, numerical goals or targets into quotas. It establishes barriers to what is meant to be a flexible and a situation-sensitive approach that Judge Moseneke indicated in the Van Heerden judgment, which was pre-Barnard. It will allocate more posts to whites than it does to minority groups within the designated classes. I think it is intrinsically racist and divisive of the persons who make up the designated groups. And fundamentally, I think that it inevitably deprives the minority groups of representation in the higher paying or more senior positions. And I don't think that that was what was intended in a democratic society. Thank you. Paul?
Over to you, Roger. I would just indicate before Roger speaks, and I'm sorry, Ways, to end up giving unions the third bite, but unions are very good at having the last word. Just two guests I just wanted to highlight. We're very happy to have our Dean, Professor Van Deville, with us. I'm so glad that you can join us, and he's always been a great supporter of Centro, so it's very good to have him in the seminar. And secondly, I see Laurie Warwick from the CCMA is here. And Laurie, as those of you know, she had her picture in the press a lot for being one of the mediators. I'm not sure what the rules for mediators are in respect of confidentiality on settlements, but if she is able to give us some idea of the process that led to that agreement, we would certainly allow her to speak shortly after Roger has finished. All right, over to you, Roger.
Thanks, Paul. I'm Meko and Shamima. Thanks very much for very interesting contributions on this issue. And you, by and large, you know, that's always the problem about going last. People have gone before you and they've cleared the way. And so in that sense, I concur with a lot of what has been said about the issues. There are just two things I want to raise. The one is that on the Employment Equity Act, I don't think, based on the problems that people are still experiencing in the workplace, etc., that the agreement that's been reached or the settlement that's been reached by between Solidarity and the department actually in any way alters the purpose or the intention of the Employment Equity Act when it was first promulgated and any amendments made since then. What has been a problem is that how inspectors and people from the department have been able to ensure that compliance with employment equity plans, et cetera, are there, and that they are basically making sure that it's been implemented in the way where the plan has been accepted, it's going to be implemented correctly. So I want to go back also to the Employment Equity Act at its inception and, for example, the transformation incorporated the question of discrimination, etc., and there were upward of about 20 different types of discrimination that was outlawed by the Employment Equity Act, both direct and indirect, and through employment policies and practices in a company. And more importantly, I think both Shamima and Meko have basically stressed the importance of the Employment Equity Act to redress injustices of the past through, amongst others, employment affirmative action measures. That such measures would not be unfair discrimination if consistent with the Employment Equity Act or the inherent requirements of the job. So that was what the Act had basically said. And designated groups were basically Black people, women, or people with disabilities. And again, there were some exceptions that were not, there were not all the employees that were employees that were covered by this. And there was then a provision about how the designated employer would be defined. And that was basically the purpose then for the requirement for them to have the employment equity plans in place, which they could do. Now, the last amendments were made in 2022, but they only became effective really in 2023. I think, as Shamima said, the most important thing out of that has been the release of these regulations, which has given rise to much debate. And I think quite important, which is missing from the Act itself and its amendments, is that the regulations seek to disaggregate Black people into Africans, colored and Indian ethnic groups. Now, we've provided quite a number of comments on the regulations. And we think that, for example, the choice of provincial or national demographics is too rigid and impractical. And as far as we're concerned, there's some employees, for example, some employers are likely to change their footprints from provincial to national and vice versa during the 5-year period that the regulations are intended to cover. Running a business in more than one province does not mean the demographics of the EAP in those provinces will align with the national EAP. And it may not be feasible and may result, in fact, in discrimination if it's carried out. To require the employer to have a workforce that reflects the national EAP in those circumstances. A proposed approach in the regulations, in our view, may lead to difficulties with implementation and will not incentivize employment of local talent and may result in an increase of internal migration of labor with the local labor force being overlooked. There's another issue that we had with the disaggregation. What it's done is, it's in our view also created levels of discrimination against what we have termed minority groups, women, persons with disabilities, people who are experiencing intersecting forms of discrimination. And as Shamima has indicated, colored and Indian persons would also be basically, if you're using EAP as the basis, some of the regulations, for example, promote sex-based discrimination. For example, in one of the sectors that they have issued regulations about, they are basically proposing the reduction of the number of women. And in its inverse, the promotion of predominantly male employers in arts, entertainment, and recreation in that economic sector. Now, those are sectors that historically have had more women employed in them. And now you say, no, we must reduce the number of women. And basically, the quotas that you're putting in there are basically targets to quotas are basically discrimination. So we think that there's a lot of problems that need to be sorted out with the regulations. We agree that the settlement agreement between Solidarity and the department is too simplistic. It doesn't in any way, in our opinion at least, alter the framework for employment equity. And what we should be looking at is how do we basically do the problem that we have with that settlement as well is that Solidarity and the department are singing the praises of the settlement and basically ignoring the fact that the EA is there, and if implemented correctly, a transformation in the workplace. So we think that they need to revisit that. And we believe that it's the good thing about it is that it has opened up the door for dialogue on this issue to CNN.
Sorry, Roger, your connection is quite bad. It's actually seems to be getting worse.
The other basically isn't. I can't think pretty much that it's meant to be a short term and at once sufficient transformation has taken place, it will by itself fall away. And that is the kind of thing that we need to be looking at. How do we make the period get transformation as quickly as possible and in substantive a way as possible so that the arguments of people who are opposed to affirmative action then holds no water. I'll leave it there. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Roger. So we usually run till about 5:30. Thanks to the speakers for keeping to their time limits and you know taking on very different slants. So I think we've got a real debate out there. Anybody indicated that they are any hands raised yet?
There's just one comment in the chat box from Marlene Portkutter that says she thinks the changes in the consultation imperative are fundamental. The way the Act was phrased in the past meant that it had to consult with both employees that were non-unionized and the union. This is how significantly they've changed. I'm not sure if anybody wants to comment on that.
I'll give him the honor of taking to the floor first.
Thanks, Roger. Paul, I mean. Didn't Laurie perhaps want to say something first?
Laurie has indicated that she does need to leave shortly and that there are, she would prefer that the CCMA deal with the issue formally in another webinar, as it was a sort of an institutional matter, and if I put her on the spot, I apologize. But, you know, it's perhaps certainly a topic we can deal with in the future. But so over to you, Darcy.
Thanks, Paul. And thanks to Meko and Shamima and Roger for giving us, I think, a very thorough coverage of the topic. I don't really want to add anything much, but to ask two questions. The solidarity settlement, I agree, it's quite a remarkable thing. It seems to express many of the kinds of views that you might have expected solidarity to entertain, which they've argued often enough in court cases. And I think it represents the extent to which the department is seeking to find, if you like, middle ground to take the controversy out of affirmative action measures. But having said that, speakers, I think Shamima and others have pointed out possible qualifications that it seems to put on the Constitutional Court interpretation of the law and possibly on the Act itself. So my question is just this, to the extent that that agreement does modify what the courts have thus far said, what the Act might say, is the agreement not ultra vires? And if made an order of court, is that court order not subject to appeal? And secondly, on the question of targets, quotas and numbers, I fully agree that the Employment Equity Act cannot and should not be a numbers game. That which it deals with is far too important for that. And I don't also think that the drafters of the Act intended it to be applied in that way or understood in that way. And that is reflected in the clear provision that employment equity targets are numerical targets. They are not quotas. In fact, quotas are unlawful. It seems to me that there are two phases to the process. The one is when measures are yet to be implemented and plans are yet to be drafted. And the second phase is after the plan's been drafted and the measures have been implemented. It seems to me that the measures are seen as targets which can't be enforced by anybody. So we have quite a few court cases to that effect, the Dudley case and others. That targets are just that. The employers must strive to reach them, but they are not necessarily reachable and are not binding. But it seems to me that what Barnard means is that once a plan has been passed and measures are taken in accordance with that plan, then the measures become unassailable. And please correct me if I'm wrong on that, but that's my understanding. But also with Barnard, it seems to me that the reason why we arrived at this result, which Shamima, I think, cast the spotlight on, Captain Barnard being denied employment to a position where, or a promotion where apparently it would have been, from operational point of view, we have been very sensible to put her, that was the problem not that the plan itself had not been challenged? I seem to recall that the courts throughout found that the fact that the plan had not been challenged means that therefore the implementation of the plan could not be challenged, and therefore should the focus not be on the content of plans if one wants to forestall outcomes that are not in accordance with the purposes of the Act, perhaps?
Thank you, Darcy. Any further hands raised? I think that falls roughly in the area that both Meko and Shamima addressed, but can I raise a question? I mean, I think it's a key issue, as Shamima has indicated, that is not often debated, and you know that is how the statute, which effectively has emerged out of challenges to public sector attempts to achieve greater efficiency, greater equity, impact in situations which are really concerned about often private sector resistance to achieving equity. And I mean, perhaps Shamima, in dealing with Darcy's question, if you could also address this, and that is not the impact to say of Barnard to say that the employer was entitled not to appoint someone because it had a rational plan, in the situation where, assuming a private sector employer who's already exceeded targets can't, for certain groups, can't find someone in respect of a designated group in respect of which they're under target, they can still, for efficiency reasons, say, appoint the best male candidate, even though females may be underrepresented at that level. And that Barnard doesn't say you can't appoint. It just says, if you make the decision after an adequate process, it can't be challenged. So I think that it's quite a key debate, that perhaps is certainly something that has never, so certainly the current public debate, which is often either defending the system or attacking it, doesn't take into account, as you said, the sophistication of the jurisprudence. But either over to any of the speakers to respond to that.
Let me try and deal with some of it. Darcy, I think you're correct that Barnard didn't attack or challenge the employment equity plan. She chose a different option. And that is to interpret the employment equity plan with the current legislation and the principle that affirmative action or targets should be broadly representative of the South African population. And she was challenging the manner of its application rather than challenging the content of that plan. Which I think she was entitled to do. When the Constitutional Court indicated quite clearly that if the decision was one taken in relation to affirmative action measures, then that can't be challenged on the basis of fairness. I think there's something fundamentally wrong with that proposition from the Constitutional Court, because the Section 6 of the Employment Act clearly provides the two defenses to any alleged disputes in terms of or claims of unfair discrimination. And the one is in relation to the one can be justified on the basis that a claim of unfair discrimination can be justified because it's an affirmative action measure in terms of 6.2. Alternatively, that it can be justified on the basis that it is an inherent requirement of the job. There is no provision in the Employment Equity Act equivalent to what the Constitutional Court has held, that any challenge to such a measure must be done on the basis of a rule of law challenge. That's the first thing. So. What is an employment equity plan? An employment equity plan is meant, I think that is perhaps the most important question. An employment equity plan is a plan that indicates what is the nature of your workplace, what is the composition of your current workforce, and what are your intended plans to transform your workplace to comply with the demographics. It's a simple simple plan. You can generally never challenge an employment equity plan, because once you have the demographics as your intended targets, well, that seals it. And I don't think that you have to challenge an employment equity plan to challenge an unfair discrimination act emerging from an affirmative action process. So that's my response to that. The second is that the issue about Paul, I think your issue was really around the issue about the targets. Maybe you can just tell me if I haven't addressed it in what I've just dealt with dealing with Darcy's question.
No, I think that does cover it. Any other hands? Can I pose a question to Mecca, which often doesn't, before you come on, Mecca, and that is, I know it's something that you've been engaged in, and you referred to, for instance, you know, the articles by Raul Causa and others this weekend, which I think raised something quite interesting that I have previously written on it. And that is the overlap and interaction between broad-based Black economic empowerment and employment equity. And, you know, what the synergies are, what falls within the gaps. And perhaps, you know, I know you've given thought to it. Perhaps you'd like to just introduce that aspect into the debate.
Yeah. No, thank you so much, Paul. Look, there is really a relationship between employment equity and the Black Economic Empowerment Act. And obviously, both of them are talking about numbers in terms of representation. You know, and the emphasis, again, is on Black representation, which in any case, when they have to assess who are leading those companies, who's in control, management, the profile, and which, again, the Employment Equity Act, the emphasis is on demographics, you know, looking in terms of the kind of reflection in terms of representation in the workplace, but theirs are more in terms of companies. And again, both of them are talking about issues of skills development in terms of training, you know, that there has to be an investment in terms of skills for the future so that there can be a transfer of skills in the future, you know, leaders. So that can be able to emerge and both manage companies as well as lead, you know, institutions as well as entity. So there's a lot of commonality. And I think the Black economic empowerment was premised mainly on what the employment equity has been talking about. And you cannot be able to separate the two because they are integral. You know, they both, I mean, they are the, you know, the two sides of the same coin, if one put it that way. And so I think for transformation, in order to be, what has been good for me about Black economic empowerment has been the barometer in terms of assessing it and having appointed, you know, the kind of verification companies to do the kind of auditing and so on, something that is not happening. And the reliance only on inspectors, which I think is the kind of weakness in terms of the enforcement. And I think now I'm glad now that they brought forward Section 53, which again reinforces, you know, the aspects that are contained in the Black economic empowerment. I just want to deal quickly, and I've been in a rush, Paul, in terms of dealing with some of the issues that were raised both by Shamima as well as Roger. I want to state first by saying, I would like to celebrate the fact that the Employment Equity Act has not been nullified at this stage. And it means that it has passed the constitutional muster and so on, and all the kind of decisions, you know, that have been actually coming from the Constitutional Court in one way or another, reinforces the idea that there is a need for employment equity, that we need to redress, you know, the past inequities and ensure that we transform our environment and we give opportunities to those that have been disadvantaged. And I think it's within the kind of the clause which is contained in terms of equality and ensuring that at least those that are disadvantaged by the previous legislation. And I think I celebrate that. And Section 15, I think, again, quickly, is very specific because in most instances, people try to undermine employment equity as if it's undermining, you know, the kind of the progress that is going to happen, you know, in the workplace or in companies. And in this case, the Employment Equity Act, particularly Section 15, emphasizes that we're looking for suitable qualified. In other words, people who are meeting the minimum requirements of the job are capable of doing the job. So you're not going to be appointing people and so on that do not meet those requirements. And secondly, the issue of discrimination that is emphasized when we have to be able to set your targets, you do not have to exclude other national groupings and in particular white males in this case, because that's not the intention, you know, that you have to put barriers and block the advancement of white males in within the workplace. And I think we learned that from Canada, you know, as it was mentioned by Shamima, that our experience around employment equity has been privileged around the experience of Canada. And I think we can be grateful to the Canadian, you know, community for having done it. I just want to deal quickly with the principles that are coming from the Barnard, which I think for me, the main enemy for employment equity has been government, government departments in particular, and particular correctional services and so on, where most of the kids, as well as the police. Those are the people that have been undermining the intention of employment equity. And I like the jurisprudence that have been developed in terms of outlining the principles that inform, you know, the issues of affirmative action and employment equity. The first one is the issue of rationality, that you, when you have to take a decision, you need to be informed by a reasonable decision, a reason that perhaps is really meeting the test of time. And the second one, obviously, the issues of fairness, that you should always ensure that there's fairness in the process. You know, and the issue of unfair discrimination comes in, you know, strongly in the employment equity in order to ensure that the processes, the practices, and the policies that we implement in our workplace always are blended, you know, with the kind of the issue of flavor of fairness. The other one is the issue of consistency that you need when you employ, I mean, implement your employment equity. You need to be consistent with your policy. It needs to be consistent with the legislation. It needs to be consistent with the constitutional, I mean, the law, with the constitution of the country. And the issue of proportionality, you know, that's where the numbers come in place. Because when you have to be able actually to do your numbers game, which you cannot avoid, but it has to be done in a more focused and intentional way, then you need to ensure that there's proportionality, you know, and ensure that, because the idea is to ensure that there's diversity in the workplace, there's equity, fair representation in terms of the national groupings or provincial groupings that you find in the place and so on. So I'm thinking that perhaps those are the kind of issues. The issue of depreciation has always become that question. And I think the Department of Employment and Labor now, the issues of emphasizing on disability, people's disabilities, on women, you know, is an issue of where they are looking in terms of, they are variables in terms of discrimination, of course. And they are trying to elevate that. Like, no, we're hearing that there has to be depreciation. And we have to be able actually to ensure that there are others that are preferred or accelerated in the process. And in this case, people with disabilities, and which is always not the issue that is raised by a number of people that are arguing and so on. And lastly, I think there is a challenge in relation to how we view the demographics, particularly term of riches and so on, because we rely in this case on the kind of benchmark that is done by the economically active population, which is released by Statistics South Africa from time to time, and where we need to align ourselves. But because we're talking about targets, you know, it helps us in any way to be able to align ourselves. And the employment equity does not talk about us. It does not, although they are coming up with numerical targets, it's a way of trying to accelerate, you know, and influence the kind of way forward. Because as you listen to the numbers that I was sharing, it's a fact that in the white place, and so in the workplace, white males are still dominant. And it's debatable whether they are African and colored and so on, and kind of coming second and so on. I think that's debatable. But the stats tell you the kind of issue that white males, and if you use EAP, economical active population, the majority could have been the African, but it's not the case, you know. So we should not always, I mean, forget about who in the majority is South Africa, and who has been disadvantaged, and again in a proportional way, and again in terms of differentiated way, you know, that Africans in particular have been the one that been most particular here in the Western Cape, you know, the kind of Job Reservation Act and a number of laws that were targeting, excluding the African majority, not to be able actually to participate. So we have to be able actually to look in terms of not to undermine that historical fact, and it is a fact. For me, that settlement agreement is a non-issue. You know, I hear you with due respect, as you know, and number of, I thought it was a non-event. It was just to buy peace. You know, I like solidarity more than any other, you know, because of late. Well, there'd be one that is taking up issues, particularly around transformation and sharpening the kind of conversation and discussion. You know, others have not been quite, you know, coming to the party. I like it for that effect, that it is active in this kind of arena. And then we can be able to sharpen our responses and to ensure that our legislation, you know, our policies are aligned thanks to solidarity. And solidarity to me is a good, you know, not that because I'm promoting it as a union that I'll ever adopt, because I do know that ideological and in terms of certain principles, I'm not in agreement with them. But for this one, I think I like what they are doing, the activism, you know, because the union are supposed to be the eyes and ears of us in the workplace to be taking up these kind of issues, but they've been playing the kind of. So I think I wanted perhaps to stop at that and I'll take you.
Paul, I thought Marlene posed a very good question, which I don't seem to be hearing any of the, as she calls it, the constitutional boffins responding to it. And that is whether Section 15.4 of the EEA actually poses a problem to the government's regulations and the intention of the regulations. And would that not be the opening then if one would want to challenge the regulations in a court of law at some stage?
Marlene, are you still here? Would you like to join in the debate and articulate that?
Paul, I think Marlene had to leave. It's Debbie okay. Here. But also there was a second point that she made, and I'm sorry, I'm straying a bit, but I also think it's an important one to make because, you know, leading on from our litigation, we tend to focus on appointments and prioritizing that, and that's what the regulations have dealt with. But she raises, you know, the other aspects of, and Meko touched on this, you know, training and skills for the future, retention, and yeah, it does seem to me we have this sort of demographic focus, which is prioritized in the context of appointments. That is what makes it to the courts. And, you know, rather than looking at other ways through appropriate development, skills and retention, you know, and in the context of retrenchments as well. I also, while I've got the mic here, I also wanted to, on the CCMA agreement, you know, it is a bit of a non-issue. Meka also touched on some of this. I do think the value in it was getting solidarity in the Department of Employment and Labor around the table. As solidarity is the one who's, you know, all of the litigation is instituted, you know, on behalf of solidarity members. They are the activist union. And so, you know, as a mediator, you're not there to draft. You're there to find out what the interests of the parties are and to get them to reach settlements. So I'm not defending the agreement, but I think it did have some value in terms of, and Meko touched on that. Sorry, Paul, I'm abusing my power. And just, I'll continue abusing my power. Just before you end off, just to thank our speakers again very much for agreeing to speak. And I'll hand over to you, Paul. Thanks.
All right. Anybody else want to join in the debate? Let me make one point about the Amendment Act, which is often not forgotten, and it's the point Mirko raised, and that is that, you know, the Act the if you want the big difference between employment equity and BEE up till now was that BEE had an effective enforcement mechanism, which was the government procurement process. So for most sectors, it's been effective, and certainly, you know, BEE has been taken a lot more seriously, and that certainly at a higher level, you know, had a higher profile level than employment equity. I think, you know, and really the problem was that prior to the amendments, there was no mechanism for enforcing the state contracting clause, which was already in the Employment Equity Act. You know, it's useful to look at, you know, if you look at the Amendment Act overall, it introduces the idea of sectoral quotas, coupled with a provision that, you know, in terms of state contracting, you have to show that you've complied with the sectoral quotas, or you've taken reasonable steps to do so. So it does seem to me what it's now doing, and this is perhaps the point, is it's saying, well, you know, you have to justify if you're not going all the way to the goals, or you know, the sectoral targets. And there, you know, that potentially is you know, a significant game changer. Provided that, you know, the department can, you know, introduce the infrastructure to monitor. I mean, one last point, and I just throw this out because it's something that interests me, and you know, I'd like, is that in a sense, you know, I think one could certainly make the case that the targets were required because, you know, as the data people have showed that, you know, in the private sector, there'd been inadequate achievement of you know, transformative goals. But you know, was there a different way of articulating those regional and sectoral targets, other than the type of, you know, the sort of very, you know, the percentage type broken down figures, which obviously have led to, you know, I think a significant level of misunderstanding about the purpose. So I just throw that out, that maybe there's no other way of expressing a target except through a table of figures. But it's clear that perhaps the manner of expression, coupled with inadequate explanation, you know, is partly responsible for, you know, the fact that you know, there's been, you know, this has been compared, you know, to job reservation under apartheid or whatever, which it certainly is not. So anywhere last comments on the topic, either from the floor or from the speakers?
Okay, can I come in? Oh, sorry.
Certainly.
Yeah. Sorry.
Just one small point, Paul, and that is that it's not clear to me whether the enforcement mechanisms of the Act have been exhausted or have been applied. Why is it that the targets are necessary to ensure compliance with the Employment Equity Act? You know, is there another way of achieving it? Is there a problem about enforcement? We haven't really been told or given that information. And really my argument is that the regulations in real terms reinforces what the Constitutional Court has held. I don't think that it's any different except for the part of the regulations that, or the amendments to the Act that indicate penalties and disadvantages for those employers who don't comply. It seems almost as if the enforcement of employment equity principles has been shifted to the party with whom the employer seeks to contract with, rather than on the state. Thank you.
Meka, would you like to come in?
Yes, please. Look, my view that the targets are just part of the entire process of dealing is one of the aspects. I think the reason why, because it's measurable, it's easy to be able actually to monitor it in terms of the numbers. But employment equity is not simply about numbers, crunching. You know, it's also about development of staff. You know, it's also about ensuring that you look at your policies to ensure fairness, you know, within your environment. It's also about creating diversity in order to use that advantage in order to really, to advance the kind of projects that we have. So, unfortunately, all the time we talk about employment equity, we always rush to numbers, and which unfortunately has been the amendment. You know, there are other substantive issues that are being raised, you know, in terms of this, but what comes up quite strongly most of the time are the numbers issues, you know, and obviously because they are challenging the status quo, that's my view, in terms of us having to be able to move from what is current to what ideally should be the future. So, I think the department, to its credit, has been trying to introduce other kind of codes dealing with people with disabilities, HIV/AIDS, psychological testing, medical testing, and a number of things that people always forget about those kind of programs that are in place whereby employment equity addresses those issues of discrimination, unfair discrimination, particularly in the workplace. I also want to disagree that this amendment is about quotas. I think the fact that there is an opportunity for employers to engage with trade unions, that for the department also to consult with them, you know, and also to present. I see what they are telling us are benchmarks. And so we still have an opportunity to go and refine our own employment equity plans. The Department of Labor is not going to develop employment equity plans and send it to us, but it's asking us to engage in a realistic, informed, you know, kind of process, whereby we look at what exactly are the kind of issues in relation to demographics and ensure proportionality, which is one of the key principles that are coming from our courts driving that kind of thing. And so it's unfortunate that the interpretation is that when you talk about numbers around employment equity, they view it that it is quotas, you know, and these are not rigid because when you as an employer sit and look in terms of your natural attrition, how many people are retiring, what are the kind of contracts that are available there, who are going to be moving on and so on, the vacancies. So those are the kind of opportunities because you as an employer have ownership in terms of trying to design a future state of affairs. And that's what perhaps, but what they are frustrated about is lack of progress. And that cannot be denied. That there's not been a lack since 1999 where I was there. As you mentioned, you know, I started the commission. The one who set up the commission was the one that sort of drove this kind of process so that it can go there. But there is no progress, you know, here that has happened since then. And hence the numbers are the same. I was looking at the current numbers in relation to 2011 when I was, you know, still in another company. I was shocked to find that the same numbers, as, you know, that reflected then are still the same. So that demonstrates a lack of commitment, a lack of will, you know, for society to transform and to embrace diversity.
Thanks very much, Mirko. Roger, any last words from you?
It's fine, thanks.
All right. Well, thanks very much, everybody. You know, my thanks to the speakers and for everyone who attended. And it's really been a very interesting debate at a pretty high level. And, you know, it was in many ways a new venture for us. Most of our previous webinars had looked at you know, more at issues around non-standard work and the expansion of law. This has certainly been a good new initiative, and certainly I think, you know, both the level of attendance and the quality of debate and the unanswered questions raised indicate that it's certainly a topic for all of us, you know, for future webinars.